I guess there's a lot of reasons to talk about Bolivia and what's happened there the last few years, but one of the main ones, I reckon, is this idea that's very prevalent around the world. And if you could identify one idea that's responsible more than any other for the continued existence of capitalism, it's this. It's just the way things are, it's just the way they have to be. You might not like the fact that we've got wars going on around the planet. You might not like the fact that torture has been rehabilitated. You might not like the fact that the richest 360 people on the planet own as much wealth as the poorest 3 billion. You might not like any of these things, but too bad, you've just got to cop it. And hopefully today, by looking at the case of Latin America in general and Bolivia in particular, I'll be able to show how a very dire situation for the working class actually gets turned around. Because if you're going into the out of the decade of the 1980s and into the decade of the 1990s, the picture is pretty bleak in Latin America. In 1967, the guerrilla hero Che Guevara was murdered by the CIA in Bolivia, dashing hopes of a guerrilla-led sort of transformation of the continent. In 1973, the reformist Allende government was overthrown by CIA-backed coup, and Chile rapidly became a sort of test case, a world laboratory, if you like, for the ideas of neoliberalism. And under the name of the Washington Consensus, these ideas of privatisation, of stripping back workers' rights, of cutting away welfare reforms and so on, became dominant and, you know, obviously not enjoyed, but accepted, passively and sullenly accepted by masses of people in Latin America through the 1980s and the 1990s. If you look at the situation today, the situation is totally different, political situation. This Washington Consensus is now dead, at least as far as the people of the region are concerned. And we've seen a series of left-wing governments, Bolivia, Venezuela, most recently in Ecuador, elected to power with a real sort of reformist agenda, which they, you know, at least have the appearance of trying to carry out with some zeal. There's also more traditional sort of right-wing social democratic governments now been elected in Chile, in Nicaragua recently, in Brazil, and also in Argentina. Now, the extent to which any of these governments have really delivered something different to the people who voted them into power, it's a very mixed picture, and I'll be looking at in a little bit of detail later on at the Morales government in Bolivia and exactly how they've measured up to the various promises that they made. But this, then, is one way of looking at what's happening in Bolivia as, you know, a case study, if you like, in a continent-wide shift to the left that's going on. You could also, and equally accurately, look at what's happened in Bolivia over the last few years, the water wars in 2000 that I'll be talking about, the gas wars in 2003 and 2005 that catapulted Evo Morales to power. You could look at these as the latest episode in a centuries-old struggle against the bloody plunder of the region's natural resources. And if you're talking about bloody plunder, then I guess a good place to start, and we're going to be skimming through a little bit of history, is with the Spanish Empire, which first came into the area, which is now called Bolivia, in the 1540s. And they found, I've got a map here, because the geography becomes a little bit important later on. I know you can't see it down the back. But they found this place, Potosi, a city which is basically sits underneath this this mountain of silver. I'll pass another map around if we want to get up close with it. Now, this the Spanish ruling class used the forced labour of Indians over a period of centuries to extract silver from this mountain. And over the 3 centuries that the mine was operating at peak capacity, the local estimate is that 8 million people died in that mine. Which, like, if you get out your calculator and work it out, that works out over 3 centuries, every single day, about 70 human beings perished to get silver out for the Spanish Empire over a period of 3 centuries. So, given that, you know, this will explain some of the intensity, I guess, of the struggle and some of the, you know, like, people in that area know just how ruthless a ruling class can be when it comes to grabbing wealth and power out of the ground. After the decline of the silver mines in the 1800s, it was the turn of the tin magnates. And for the century or so, from the 1880s up to the 1980s, about 20% of the world's tin came from the tiny country of Bolivia. Now, this created enormous fortunes. There was a fellow, Simon Patino, who one of the tin magnates in Bolivia. He was one of the 6 richest people in the world in the 1940s. But, of course, the people mining the tin didn't really get much share of it. The harsh conditions in the mine, the concentration of the miners in very tight-knit communities, the fact that they were concentrated in a major export industry, all of this led to them, or helped to lead to them, becoming one of the most militant sections of the working class in Latin America. And, they're an explosive section, if you can use the pun, in another sense as well, because of their habit, when they go on political marches, of chucking dynamite around to announce their arrival, and the fact that you want to take them seriously, you don't want to get in their way. These tin miners played a decisive role in the Bolivian Revolution of 1952, where the working class basically stormed La Paz, the capital, which is up here, again in the mountains. I can't go through the whole history, but handed power over, rather than holding power themselves as the working class, handed power over to a bunch of nationalist leaders who slowly, there was a bunch of reforms introduced, the mines were nationalised, social welfare introduced and so on. But those nationalist leaders eventually turned on the working class, and by 1956 the army was being used quite regularly to repress strikes. There was another upsurge and struggle in 1971, which was similarly crushed. A period of military government after that, a series of uprisings, and again in 1982, the miners were central to the storming of La Paz and conquering democracy, winning democracy back from the military dictatorship. But in 1985, on the advice of the International Monetary Fund, the tin miners were smashed. The mines were privatised, and this coincided with a dramatic slump in the price of tin around the world, and about half the miners, about 37,000 of them, found themselves out of a job. And this was the signal, for the full onslaught of neoliberalism in Bolivia. And over the decade and a half that followed, everything that you can think of was privatised. And it's a pretty familiar story from Australia. State utilities such as Telecom, the power, railways, airlines, many factories, the Bolivian National Oil Company, the YPFB, were all privatised. And this was particularly catastrophic for the Bolivian working class, which up to 1985, about 60% of Bolivian workers were employed in the state sector. So the result was really catastrophic. The labour laws were gutted, and there was a massive growth in the so-called informal employment, cash employment. Now, the extraordinary thing, given the history of militancy of the Bolivian working class, it's quite notable that this whole process, from the miners being smashed onwards, was met with almost no struggle from the working class. The working class was disoriented, was cowed, voted for a series of right-wing presidents and congressmen who perpetuated these neoliberal politics. And I guess the sort of current situation, very different from that. How did that situation get turned around? How did this sort of, the devastation of neoliberalism get turned into the massive upsurge in struggle that's happened over the last few years? And the key turning point is the water war in Cochabamba in the year 2000. Now, there's a fantastic book, I really don't have time to do any of the struggles I'm talking about justice, but if you want to read about the water wars, this is one of the best books I've read in the last year or so. It's by Oscar Oliveira, who was a shoemaker and then got a job for the Shoemakers Union. Now, in the 1990s, he and a bunch of other unionists decided, look, there's no point in us just covering the workers in the formal sector. We'll set up a workers' organising centre in the main plaza. Workers in the informal sector could come in. We'll see if we could deal with their problems, have political protests about them, and so on. Now, they had, some mixed success. They won a few little victories and so on. In 1999, a group of indigenous farmers from outside, this is all happening in Cochabamba, by the way, right in the heart of Bolivia. In 1999, a group of indigenous farmers from just outside the city came in and said, well, you're doing stuff for the workers, but, you're not doing anything about our water rights. And, Oscar and all of their friends sort of scratched their heads. It had really never occurred to them that water would be a political issue that could actually mobilise people. Earlier in 1999, Cochabamba had always, for 50 years or more, had problems with its water supply. Early in 1999, the Bolivian government had privatised that water supply. So cooperative water supplies that the community had built up over decades, especially in the poor south of the city, were now private property. All the water in Cochabamba province was now the property of Bechtel, the giant US multinational. Even the rainwater was the property of Bechtel. If you caught rain from your roof, if you stuck a pot out to catch some rain, you were breaking the law unless you paid Bechtel some money. It was really that extreme. But people have copped the privatisation of everything. People really didn't think, oh, well, shit, we'll give it a go. We'll call a rally, see if anyone turns up. the 1st of December 1999, they called a rally, and to their enormous surprise, about 10,000 people turned up in the middle of Cochabamba. And they were very encouraged by this and thought, okay, well, let's give the government a month or so. January the 11th, you better reverse the privatisation or we'll be back. At this time, we'll shut the city down. And again, they weren't really sure whether they'd be able to, whether they'd be able to do this. But January the 11th came. Sure enough, they managed to shut large parts of the city down, at least for the day. But January the 12th, especially in the city itself, business really got back to usual. We saw Star Wars. We've had our token protest. Now we'll just get on with being defeated. But the farmers in the countryside were really quite agitated about it, and there the protests and the road blockades persisted for a number of days. Encouraged by this, they called another action for February the 4th. Again, it was mainly farmers who turned up, but this time they marched into the centre of the city and said, OK, we're going to try to, storm the local Congress building. They were attacked by the cops who prevented them from doing this, and it was this battle that slowly, slowly started to draw the city people into the confrontation. Oscar's got a lovely story in there about he and his friends had been tear gassed and they took refuge in a particular house, and they were explaining to the people in the house, you should really be out there protesting as well, it's going to really increase your water bills and so on. Sure enough, later in the day, when they came past, these people were involved in building a barricade in the street to help the, fight the cops off. This sort of process was happening all over the city, and by the end of the day, a large part of the city was in the hands of the rebels. Now, capitalism depends on a certain stability for its operation. The bosses need us to really turn up to work, their goods to get around their cities and so on, but need us to obey their laws. When large chunks of the population simply refuse to do this, they've really got a problem on their hands, which they can respond to either with repression or with concessions or both. And this can be a very difficult juggling act for them to work out which will actually defuse it. In this case, nothing defused it. They announced in February, the government announced, okay, we'll reverse the privatisation, but then they did nothing, hoping that the protesters would just go away. So in April, again, the protesters launched a series of blockades. And after some, they tried to storm the Congress building again, the police repressed them, they ended up with 40,000 people, and then the town really just exploded. And I'll read a little section so you get a feel for how these protests work, because the pattern's repeated again in 2003 and in 2005. We held a town meeting on the spot to discuss strategy and tactics, and it was decided that we would occupy the main plaza until we had our answer and the water company was gone. That's when we were told that plane loads of soldiers were on the way. We gave instructions that, as in February, everyone should take up combat positions around the plaza, dispersing themselves throughout the neighbouring blocks. People got ready all over the city. You could see on every corner the role that each family had been assigned. Children, old folks, young men and women, all of them had faces painted as in war. Young people wore leather gloves to hurl back the gas canisters. You saw others with gloves holding barbed wire to string on posts from one side of the street to the other. Others had bottles ready to break on the ground. Middle-aged women were ready with a bucket of water to throw on the gas canisters. You saw these things going on in every street. He describes one street that he went up and there was a child's tricycle in the middle of the street with a whole lot of sticks and stuff arranged around it. And he came up to about his knee and he realised that it was the really little kids had gotten out and they were starting to build barricades as well. Really the whole population got involved. So on April 9, after several days of this sort of fighting, the government simply caved in. And this really was the signal for, a lot of episodes of struggle happened straight after that. In September 2000, Indigenous communities in the area, the High Plains around La Paz, started putting on road blockades to demand, some sort of self-government of their own communities. In January 2003, coca growers, who were sort of more in the east, started road blockades to protest against the US-backed eradication program. There's probably a whole talk to do about the politics of coca, but a lot of these people had been actually sacked from the mines, had gone off to grow coca, and carried a lot of those militant union traditions with them. In February 2003, there were mass protests about a hike in income tax. The clashes ended up leaving 33 people dead. The police but they were successful in having the gas increase withdrawn. Also in this period, it was discovered that Bolivia's gas reserves were actually the second largest on the continent after Venezuela. And in the middle of 2003, the government announced a new deal whereby British and Spanish, there you go, transnational corporations would transport the gas from Bolivia to the US. And the conditions of the deal were such that the Bolivian state, thank you, would only receive about 18% of the value of the gas. So a lot of the same people, Oscar was involved, a lot of the same people who were involved in the water war set up the Coordinadora, again, the gas coalition. And on September the 19th, 2003, some 150,000 people demonstrated throughout Bolivia demanding the nationalisation of the gas and demanding that, you know, the wealth from the gas be, that there be a democratic process to decide what should be done with it. The demonstration happened. The next day, the military police, in a sort of unrelated, seemingly incident, military police attacked a road blockade set up as part of that indigenous uprising behind La Paz. The military's action resulted in 7 deaths, including the death of the killing of an 8-year-old girl by the military. And this really galvanised all of the rural sectors, the unemployed and miners from the regional areas started to join in the action. Indigenous workers marched through El Alto, which is a huge town city near La Paz, we'll talk about in a sec, shouting, "Now for sure, civil war." And the next day, the gas coalition vowed solidarity with Indigenous protesters. And from here, things really escalated. The COB, the Trade Union Federation, called a strike beginning on September 30, which took a little while to get off the ground, but again, the government repression, the government killed between 60 and 80 people in this period, eventually prompted workers to lose their fears or to overcome their fears of losing their job and just to get out in the street and away from their jobs. The road blockades all around La Paz, the capital, was effectively cut off for a number of weeks, and a key role was played by the people of El Alto, a city of 800,000 people, almost entirely indigenous, which sits about 1,000 feet above La Paz, so I think it's about 13,000 feet, which is twice as high as any mountain we've got in Australia. Now, again, a lot of the miners who'd been sacked in the 1980s had ended up in El Alto, and the community had to be started from scratch. And a lot of the collective traditions of the miners and of the indigenous people were brought into that new shanty town. So there's no sort of classic trade unions there, or they're very weak, but there are these neighbourhood assemblies that organise every street. There's something like 550 of these neighbourhood assemblies that organise every neighbourhood. And participation is compulsory. If you don't come to a neighbourhood meeting, you're fined. If the neighbourhood meeting decides that we're going on a march, you know, tomorrow, whatever, and you don't come, you have to pay a fine. There's a very strong collective tradition. Okay, so all of this sort of mobilisation continued to strangle La Paz into October. There were national highway blockades and so on. And on October the 17th, with large sections of the country basically ungovernable, the president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, fled to safe haven in Miami to join various generations of scumbags who have lived in similar situations. And receiving praise as he went from the US government for his services to his country and to democracy. So round one in the gas war goes to the workers and peasants. Lozada's deputy Carlos Mesa becomes president and he promises a referendum on the issue of gas in 2004. And there's, you know, like things are pretty stable for 2004, but when the wording of the referendum is released, it's clear that you can really interpret these things to mean anything that you want. So that, again, you know, the coalition that put together the gas war in 2003 was quite unhappy. By the middle of May 2005, still nothing had happened, still there was no nationalisation, and the protests resumed. And I really unfortunately don't have time to sort of go through, you know, day by day by day. Like, it's not hard to find on the internet just how the thing develops. But I do have a few pictures which another comrade printed out for me from the mobilisations of 2005. I've got 3 copies. They're all the same pictures, so you can sort of pass them around. The main picture, I suppose, is of marchers coming down from El Alto to La Paz. Down in the bottom left, these people in cheap parkas that you can see ripping up cobblestones and forming barricades, they're the teachers. They've got a very militant union in La Paz. May 16, you have 100,000 people marching down from El Alto down to La Paz. A couple of days later, you've got 1,000 miners chucking their dynamite come down. And this time, Like, the demand is for nationalisation, but the other demand is for Carlos Mesa resign, and the other demand is for closed parliament. Like, it's a waste of time. You people have been talking for, you know, for 18 months about this thing that we demanded and that you promised us. Nut, you're out. And so they were chanting, Mesa, traitor, we want your resignation, and chucking dynamite. It's quite a scene. By May 23, we have an indefinite general strike from the El Alto region. More stories with dynamite. True. Okay. And by the first weekend in June, the capital of La Paz is basically totally stopped. In Cochabamba as well, and Oruro, which is down here somewhere. Again, there's large demonstrations, including the occupations of gas refineries. Thank you. On June the 7th, Carlos Mesa announced that he would resign, and after weeks of Congress failing to meet, the next in line to the presidency, the Senate leader, Juan Armando Bacadíez, announced that the session would convene not in La Paz, the capital, but in Sucre, way down here, a whole lot of mountains and valleys away from the protesters, he hoped, on June the 9th. So, thousands of protesters from the local area then convene on the national capital, Sucre. And saying, no, we're not going to accept Bacadíez, we're not going to accept the third in line, because they're both connected to sort of very right-wing oligarchy centred on agribusiness and the cocaine trade and petroleum nowadays, which is centred on Santa Cruz in the east. The climax of the struggle really was June the 9th, 2005. In the morning, the Congress building is surrounded by members of mass organisations. The major highways are blocked for the third day running. Some 119 highways are blocked all over the country. The Santa Cruz gas fields are taken over by the workers. Pipeline valves are shut down in Cochabamba and La Paz. Airline workers have shut down all of the country's airports. In El Alto, the Popular Assembly issues a six-point declaration that begins by declaring that El Alto is now the general headquarters of the Bolivian Revolution of the 21st century. It announces the formation of a unified leadership. Its central demand is the nationalisation of hydrocarbons, oil and natural gas. It agrees to form people's assemblies in every department and rejects electoral solutions and constitutional successions. The morning of June the 9th also brought the, surprisingly really, given the amount of dynamite that was thrown around, this brings the only fatality in the struggle, during this phase of the struggle, when soldiers killed the head of a mine workers' local union. And at this point, government authority basically collapsed for a period, as popular action prevented Congress from meeting. So, revolutions can happen when, it's said, when the ruling class can't continue to govern in the old way, and when the masses, the working class, refuses to be governed in the old way. And obviously both of these things apply in early June in Bolivia in 2005. The mobilised mass of the people were the only authority in the country. The state was really nowhere. And this was an opportunity for a new sort of power to be born in Bolivia, where it was not just a matter of shutting the country down, but of the people constituting themselves and saying, we, the people who create all of the fabulous wealth, who extract all of this fabulous wealth, we will decide what we produce. We will decide how we produce it. We will decide how we distribute it. In other words, it was a revolution. It was a possibility for a socialist revolution. But yet, there was no revolution. And if you want to look at the reason why, there was no fundamental reordering of society in June in 2005. The reason is fairly straightforward, and that is that there was no revolutionary party. There was an extraordinarily, tense situation. There was a situation of, a power vacuum. There was a situation, where the masses were the only power, but there wasn't an organised body with authority in different parts of the country that could say, okay, this is the time. The workers should really seize power now. And this isn't just my analysis. This is a quote from, there's actually quite a lot of discussion on the net. You can find it reflecting this from Bolivia. But this is a quote from, wrong page. There was a quote after the struggle. There we go. This is from the union. A mass meeting was held in La Paz after the whole situation died down and reached this conclusion. This is organised by the Trade Union Federation. And the conclusion was this, and I'm quoting, after initiating and leading a great social upheaval, The workers, the peasants, the oppressed nations, and the impoverished middle classes did not bring down the power of the dominant class because they had no revolutionary party to rely on. Now, there's a lot sort of more to that statement, but I'm running low on time, so I'm going to have to skip it. But so there wasn't a revolutionary party. What there was the movement towards socialism, the MAS, which was led by Evo Morales. And I'm missing the page. There it is. Okay. All right. Now, Evo Morales. If you look at him from Australia, man, he's a pretty impressive figure, you know. Compare him to, like, Kevin Rudd. And he's like, man, the man actually stands for something, you know. Like, he actually puts his neck out a bit. He actually, you know, fights for a better world. And he's been doing it for a long time. He was, organising coca growers since his teenage years. But at various key points in the struggle that I've described, the MAS and Evo Morales were actually like in the rear of the struggle, being dragged along by the masses. And, you know, just a few examples. The 2003 general strike wasn't endorsed by the MAS until the second week when it had already taken off. Evo Morales was actually expelled from the Union Federation, the COB, over this, because they think that he should have gotten involved a lot earlier. MAS, unlike almost all of the rest of the Bolivian left, supported the referendum in 2004, and for most of 2004, he was actually the main prop of the Carlos Mesa government, which was continuing all of the neoliberal policies that we know and hate so well. MAS paid the price for this, like their vote. Evo Morales had got about 22% in the 2002 presidential election. By the middle of 2004, when the municipal elections were held, he was receiving only 11% of the vote, so people were turning their back on Evo Morales. He responded by jumping to the left and placing himself eventually, trying to place himself at the head of the movement in 2005. But even there, like, MAS was pushing a line of not full nationalisation as the rest of the movement was pushing, but just an increase in the royalties received from the gas exploitation. Okay, there's various other examples, but I don't have time to go into this. But for all of this, Morales still had enormous credibility in various sections of the country, and he had an organisation which was coherent enough to impose its will, and in this case, in early June, impose a settlement. So on the 9th of June in the evening, Bolivia drew back from revolution, and the command passed to the third in charge, the head of the Supreme Court, who was authorised to call elections for later in 2005. In these elections, Morales swept to power with 54% of the vote, which is totally unprecedented in Bolivia. I don't think a president had ever been elected with a majority vote before. And he was the first indigenous president to be elected as well in a majority indigenous country. But yes, it's basically the same institutions as before. Now, I've got to finish up by talking about what's happened since then. And there's a lot of different areas that I could cover, what's happened with the coca growers, what's happened with the Constituent Assembly, but I'll focus on three briefly to give you, and hopefully that will give you a general picture of what's happened. Starting with land, which is obviously a vital issue in a country where I think it's still around half of the population live in rural communities. And of that 4 million or so people, 4 or 5 million people, a recent survey by the Catholic Church found that 50,000 families own almost 90% of Bolivia's productive land. So Morales has promised to distribute 20 million hectares within 5 years to peasants and indigenous communities, and so far about 3.8 million hectares have actually been distributed to 60 different indigenous communities. The thing is, though, that he's doing so, like, at the same time, he's saying that he's not going to confiscate any private property. This is a quote from him. The right has said, Evo will not respect private property. Evo will end private property. How false is that? What a lie. How could I think of finishing off with private property, compañeros? What he did was distribute state-owned lands, and they're generally very poor quality. So it's remote forests, it's desert areas, it's the least arable lands that he's, you know, that were possible for him to distribute first off. He proposed a bill, he's now got a bill through, which will allow some limited confiscations of land, but only if it's not being used for socially productive purposes. And so the great landowners, they're not going to be touched by it, and they've even been given time to bring that land into productive use. even that very limited land reform was too much for the oligarchy, like the agribusiness oligarchy centred on Santa Cruz. And they pulled their senators out of the Senate, which deprived the Senate of a quorum. Now, at that point, Evo Morales said, well, if the Senate does not want to change the law, the people will rise up and change it by force. So he is prepared to use popular mobilisations. He called a march to march to La Paz to force the hand of the Senate. He is prepared to use popular mobilisations to overcome the obstruction of the right. And eventually, enough senators trickled back into the chamber to vote that limited reform through. But it's a different story when people mobilise to his left, and there has been extremely hostile. And there's been an increasing number of incidents just this year where poor communities and poor families have moved onto idle land owned by the big landowners and been pushed off by police or by the army even, and there's even been a number of fatalities in those incidents. Gas would be the second thing, and obviously that's the, it was the gas war that catapulted Morales to power. On May Day last year, he announced, well, his popularity shot to 80% after he announced that the gas reserves would be nationalised and sent the army in to seize control of the various gas facilities and refineries and so on. This was pretty much just show, though. Like, the army was fairly quickly withdrawn. They're not sort of permanently based there. And the nationalisation decree only applied to the actual gas under the ground. All of the refineries and all the rest of it on top, to actually get the gas out of the country, was left in private hands. What he also did was, basically it's become an exercise in renegotiating a whole lot of the oil and gas contracts, and trying to get a more favourable deal out of these multinational gas companies. But even there, like, there's been a lot of compromising. In August of last year, the minister responsible for hydrocarbons, Solis Rada, decided to put back under state control refineries that had been privatised to Petrobras, which is a huge Brazilian gas company. Brazil gets something like 2/3 of its gas from Bolivia. And said the hydrocarbons minister had said, look, these things have been illegally privatised in the past. We're just going to take them back. Thank you very much. Morales responded to this, or his deputy at least responded to this, by sacking the hydrocarbons minister, sacking the entire team that was doing the renegotiation, and appointing as the new team to renegotiate all of these deals with these multinational gas giants, a new team which consisted of a former sales manager for Petrobras, a former legal advisor to Petrobras, like basically the same people who'd been looting the country for years were now in charge of renegotiating the oil and gas contracts. So though they have increased the royalties and taxes significantly in some cases, still there's a lot of gas being sold at about a quarter of the market price to Brazil, like huge quantities. So the contradiction between the rhetoric of, the gas belongs to the people, we'll use this to, for social programs and so on, and the reality has actually been quite stark. And was brought into focus down in the south around Camiri, a town there where there's a Shell refinery. And in February this year, the people of Camiri occupied that refinery and said, look, all this wealth is coming out of the ground, but we're still poverty-stricken, where's the employment? Basically, the state-owned oil company, which was meant to be, a partner, they just run the gas bottling plant out the back of this enormous Shell refinery. There's nothing in it for us. Morales responded by sending in the army and left 8 people injured. So, yeah. So it's this line of, you own the gas, you might not see any wealth from it, but, if you try to actually take it and try to take that wealth, we'll send the army in. The third and the final issue, and I'll finish on this, is the issue of autonomy. And this is, it's called the Media Luna, these four eastern states, which you can notice, like the Andes sort of runs through here, that's where all the tin was from, that's where the tin miners had all of their tradition of militancy. These areas haven't had that same tradition of militancy, and are much more under the control of the right-wing oligarchy, especially centred on Santa Cruz. And these four states have been demanding autonomy. It's basically a matter of saying, stuff the indigenous people, we've exploited them for centuries, but no, we don't need them anymore. We've got all the gas in our area, and we want to, as much control as we can get, even to the point of independence. Now, Morales, his attitude to this has basically been a series of concessions. He allowed a referendum to take place on the issue of autonomy, which was opposed by the left and the social movements and the unions. In the middle of last year, he approved the private exploitation of the Mutun mine, which I haven't been able to find on the map, but it's the largest lump of iron in the world, and it's in the Santa Cruz area. And he's approved private exploitation of that by these same oligarchs who were sort of organising against him. But one, like, I mean, I could sort of, there's a lot more detail I could give you, but one thing that maybe sums it up is what's happened in Cochabamba earlier this year. Cochabamba, in the referendum on autonomy, voted very solidly against autonomy. 63% of people said, no, we want to stay part of Bolivia, thank you very much. But the right-wing governor there announced in December last year that he was going to hold another referendum. Now, the response of this was for the Cochabamba social movements to start to mobilise in the style which I've described a couple of times already. The thing was, in January, the protests had died down a little, but there were still protesters occupying the central square. A fascist group was confident enough, they're called Youth for Democracy, a fascist group was confident enough to break through police lines and assault a bunch of indigenous people with baseball bats, lead piping and so on. And shouting racist insults. In this bloody confrontation, two people died. And this is pretty extraordinary that the right wing are confident enough to do this in Cochabamba, of all places, which is really, apart from El Alto, is really, the centre of the left. Now, in response to this, there was an enormous mobilisation. The whole city was shut down. People occupied, tens of hundreds of thousands of people occupied the square permanently, constituted themselves as, Governor clear off. We are the new, prefecture, the people's prefecture, they call themselves, and said, well, okay, we were just demanding that the referendum be withdrawn. Now we demand that the governor resigns entirely. Now, the governor responded by saying, oh, look, I've just been misinterpreted over this referendum thing. I didn't really mean it. So he sort of withdrawn that proposal. But they said, nah, not good enough. We want you out. And at this point, Evo Morales stepped in and said, well, look, really, compañeros, you have to respect what he called democratic legality, you have to go back home in the protest and acknowledge that, the governor is going to return. And in response to this, and I'll finish with this, is a leaflet was put out by the coordinadora, which says, in response to Evo Morales talking about so-called democratic legality. And the leaflet was headed, instead of the neoliberal legality, popular legitimacy. The social conquests have never been the English is a little bit mangled in the translation. The social conquests have never been the product of legality, have not been laws nor judges, those that have changed the country. Has always been the people in the streets. 1952, 1978, 1979, 1982, 2000, 2003, 2005 are dates where the people, breaking all legality, initiated the April Revolution, reconquered democracy, demanded land and territory, defeated the dictatorship of Pereira, Banza and of García Meza. Since 2000, with the war to war, the courageous people of Cochabamba began the long fight to defeat neoliberalism. The gas war recovered the popular will as the only legitimate instrument of vindication over the legality that only favoured the rich and powerful, and also over the opportunistic political parties that only think about taking advantage of power, which is a not-so-subtle DGET-MAS. We are militants of the autonomy of the movements and social organisations. We think that another Bolivia is possible and that the people are the legitimate owner of the construction of its present and its future. This is a fight between the wealth of a few and the poverty of millions. It is a fight until death for life. And I'll let them have the last word.